It's a comedy podcast. I hope you've all got wit.
Oh, God.
Sound effects. Wow, wow.
I did wonder. I thought, I just can't. This is going to be fun. Welcome to the Silent London Podcast Comedy Special, presented in association with SOAS Radio. Hi, I'm Pamela Hutchinson, the editor of the Silent London website, and I'll be your host today. With me in the studio today, as always, is a man famed in song, producer Pete Barron.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello, Pete. We also have two guests to introduce to you. First is Aisha Bechet, historian and chaplain aficionado, who writes the Charlie's London series for the blog. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, and we also have to my left Mr. Phil Concannon, who reviews and writes about cinema mostly for his own site, philonfilm.net.
Hello.
Hello, Phil. Today we're indulging ourselves with a feast of silent comedy. Aisha and Phil will be helping us to decide who's the king of the silent clowns, Buster or Charlie. We'll also be talking about some lesser known names and studios that gave us so many silent laughs. And we've got a transatlantic contribution too from Toronto-based blogger Chris Edwards, who will be telling us about his favourite silent. It's a comedy, but it's a heartbreaker too. Plus, we'll be reviewing some recent shows and taking a look at what is coming up on the Silent London calendar. If you want to get in touch with us about anything you hear on the podcast, you can email silentlondonpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at silent_London, or you can leave a message on the Facebook page, facebook.com/silentlondon. Some people think that comedy is all there is to silent cinema. They're wrong, of course, but the silent era did bring us some fabulous, inventive, hilarious laughs. The films of Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Laurel and Hardy, and of course Charlie Chaplin continue to entertain in grand style, as anyone who has paid a visit to the Slapstick Festival in Bristol will know. Later in this programme, we'll be looking at some of the lesser-known names, but first, the Titans. If, as Vincent Vega says, you're either a Beatles man or an Elvis man, then it stands to reason that sooner or later you have to decide which you prefer, Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin. So it's over to our guests now. And who decided they wanted to go first?
Shall I go first?
Okay, so Phil is going to defend his comedy idol.
I've always been a Buster Keaton man, and it really comes down to his face, that great expressionless face, which Louise Brooke described as the most beautiful face of any man she had ever seen. What I love about that face is the way his expression never changes, no matter what disaster befalls him, as many disasters do. And it's very enigmatic. It can be read as a look of bewilderment or dismay or resignation. And he's like the eye at the centre of the hurricane, literally in Steamboat Bill Jr. He was an incredible stuntman, as well as an incredible actor and director. I love his commitment to the large-scale stunts, the motorcycle chase in Sherlock Jr., the aforementioned hurricane, the gang warfare scene in The Cameraman, or the bride chase in Seven Chances. He really could take a joke and run with it like nobody else. His greatest film, I think, among many great films, is Sherlock Jr., which I think is one of the most perfect films ever made, and a film decades ahead of its time in its comment on cinema and its comment on our relationship with cinema. He was, I think, a more visual director than Chaplin. I think he cared slightly more about how the films looked, and for example, The General was described as the greatest Civil War film ever made by Orson Welles. It had a real sense of realism to it. And I also think that his career, although it didn't last as long as Chaplin's, I think he had a greater spread of fantastic films with his shorts as well as his features. Some of his great short films were One Week, which was his first film and one of the best short films ever made, The High Sign, The Playhouse, and The Goat. As I say, both have their virtues, but I'm very much in Keaton's corner when it comes to the great silent comedians.
Oh, that's a pretty convincing case, I have to say. We do have someone in Chaplin's corner, luckily, to defend a silent Londoner on Silent London. Aisha, over to you.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Chaplin's a very personal thing. And I think the difference between Keaton and Chaplin is that
Chaplin is a very personal thing. He will leave you, when you walk out of a theatre, you will be thinking about his films for hours after, whereas because Keaton's much more visual, you may not necessarily be, because of the message between them. Now, for me, I am a Londoner, and I'm a South Londoner, and I'm a very, very proud South Londoner, born in the Woolworth Road, basically, born definitely in the Borough of Southwark, so... To me, he speaks volumes. You can still walk around London. You can still get that vibe of what he was talking about. You only have to watch The Kid and be from South London and actually feel, you know what, this man actually, South London never left him. And I will argue with anyone about that, South London never left him, because there's a fantastic scene in The Kid where he gets that little boy off of the orphan carriage and he just stands there with his hand and he actually does his buttons of his jacket up. Very South London, very, doesn't matter what you think about me, I'm going to come out of this fight looking tidy. And I think that the Tramp is a very tidy character. Winston Churchill said the Tramp was a very British character. It was a very British Tramp. And you didn't find hobos in America looking like him. And I think that, you know, you have that big sense of... For me, it's definitely a big sense of pride. I'm not just going to talk about that, though, because it's definitely a lot to do with the films. There's a great, strong message in all of the films. One of my favourite films of his is The Circus. And I really feel that it gets left behind. It gets left behind because of what was going on in Chaplin's personal life at the time. He doesn't even mention it much in his autobiography. It's sort of really brushed over because of the bad things that's going on with his mother dying and his second divorce. But visually, that is an amazing film. What's clever about it is he subtly challenges Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton, but he does it completely in his own way, in the fact that he still has that strong message of pathos and sentiment and sympathy, but he throws some stunts in there as well. And to this day, I can't watch the scene with the monkeys without itching. So that's my argument.
Oh, that's great. Well, you've both mentioned two of my all-time favourite Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin films. So
you're torn.
I'm torn because I love Sherlock Jr. and I love The Circus. I'm a big fan of The Circus. I thought there were some really great points. I mean, I thought when you were talking about Buster Keaton's face, what I love about it is that, you know, is this idea that it is expressionless, that he's a stone face, but actually you can see these little twinges. Each cheekbone expresses tetchiness or dismay. I'm thinking sort of like at the end of The Boat, when everything's just gone terribly wrong and he's looking at his wife in kind of, you know, utter disdain for what's happened to him. And also, I thought, you know, when you're talking about character, when you're saying that the Tramp was a British character, I mean, for me, I think that's really resonant. I think that's one of the reasons he seemed so strange and odd, because he's sort of like a poet gentleman, isn't he? You know, when you have that ridiculous phrase, gentleman of the road, you know, he really is. You know, he's always got his head in the stars, hasn't he?
Yeah.
And, you know, he's kind of like Oscar Wilde in Dirty Trousers. I love it. And we may talk about trousers quite a bit later. We've been doing some trouser-based research, is all I can say. Now, I want to bring Pete in here, because you've been reading a lot about the sort of classic silent comedy era, haven't you, from Hollywood?
Yeah, I've been reading, I've got it in front of me in here, actually, the Simon Lovish Keystone, Max Sennett biography, basically, which is really quite interesting about the whole studio setup for the period. And I think it's... There's a lot, obviously, I didn't know. I mean, obviously, both Keaton and Chaplin came through Keystone briefly, or Chaplin was there not for very long. And Keaton was there doing some stuff with Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle. And it's just the sort of development of the two-reeler. And then, I mean, Sennett certainly stuck with the two-reeler a bit longer than maybe he should have done. And, I mean, it's interesting that when we talk about Keaton and Chaplin, one of the reasons why they're so well known, or one of the reasons why they resonate so much now, is because there are feature films as well. And I think definitely over the last 30 years we have fallen out of love with two reelers. I mean, not, I don't think anyone in this room has, but I think TV doesn't know how to deal with them, and because we see film as a feature length thing, that the two reelers are less in favour. And certainly Max Sennett's two reelers are quite hard. They tend to follow quite a formula. There's quite a lot of physical and violence based pratfalls. There's a couple of minutes of Bathing Beauties in the middle, and a little bit more violence again. But when you think of all the people who came through Sennett, Mabel Normand was Sennett, Charlie Chase was there originally, Harold Lloyd did a bit with Sennett. It's really interesting that those films now aren't seen. I mean, Keystone Cops is probably the, if you talk about the sort of legacy of Keystone Studios. People think of Keystone Cops.
And the Go Compare advert. That the Go is Compare the legacy advert of Matt Sennett.
Is the legacy. Well, also with Keystone Cops as well, it also then brings us all the things that those of us who like silent films, whenever you talk about silent films to a non-silent film fan, often thinks about. So it is that, it is the did-little-did, all that kind of stuff, which comes straight out of Keystone. But it would be wrong to say that Max Sennett's contribution wasn't huge. And then latterly Hal Roach and the Hal Roach Studios, which went much more into the talkies shorts as well. So when we talk about Lauren Hardy talking, you know, a lot of the, when we're talking about the people who made the brief transition, part of the problem was a lot of them were two-reelers. And so it was the sort of demise of the two-reeler. And as Hal Roach said himself later, that Max Sennett, the violence and the kind of slapstick in Max Sennett, by the time it got into the talkies, was being done better by cartoon. Yeah.
I think there's definitely a problem. I don't know. I mean, you know, we always want to avoid cliche, although, you know, I'm going to fall back on them quite a lot while I'm talking here off the cuff. But it's really impossible for people to say the word slapstick without putting the word crude in front of it. Mm-hmm. And it's just not true. I mean, either Chaplin or Keaton, you were talking about very, very sophisticated work. And even Keystone Cops, I mean, you tried driving a car off a pier.
Well, the amazing thing about Chaplin and Keaton was how they were both kind of perfectionists, especially Chaplin, who would take dozens of takes of a single scene, and yet you don't see any of that effort in the finished product. When you know what's gone into it, it still seems so chaotic and so happenstance, as if it's just, you know, falling apart in front of your eyes. And they were both so balletic as well, and they both had such grace.
Yeah.
That's the thing that you really notice in them. The way their bodies moved was really just an incredible thing to behold. There have been very few performers who have been able to do that and kind of keep taking the hits and keep getting up. It's a real skill and an art form when it's done well. Obviously, yeah. there's good slapstick and bad slapstick, as with anything else. And there's a bit more bad than good probably sometimes. But it was really the most polished and the most high end when you were talking about these two guys.
I mean, I always feel that when people say about the sentiment with Chaplin, they never really talk about the dynamics and actually the physical labour that went in. And I think with Chaplin, his physical labour went in a lot behind the camera. But actually, I always find that people that say this about the, you know, the pathos and all this stuff, they don't watch them properly. They watch the odd one. They see that very famous scene from The Kid where he finally gets the child back. They don't, you know, and that's their level. But watch The Pawn Shop. When he's rocking on that ladder, he could have broken his neck. They talk about the Keystone Studios. Chaplin, one of the reasons he left the Keystone Studios and didn't renew his contract was because the films were too fast-paced. They were churning out too many films and he wanted to put much more quality over the quantity of them. And I think that says a lot about the artistic style of him, definitely.
That's very true. I mean, the Sennett stuff, if you look at the development of the tramp role, I mean, in a lot of ways, of course, Max Sennett's studio, Keystone Studios, kind of owned the tramp. But let
Mabel
him,
Normand. She was directing.
She was directing.
It's all down to a woman.
And she does do. And she does do the in she's the first real Chaplin copyist. I mean, you get Charlie Aplin, who's the Mexican Charlie Chaplin.
And Stan Laurel and Harold Lloyd.
And of course, and Chaplin was always in a difficult situation with his impersonators because obviously his brother was one of his biggest impersonators. So the two reelers that he was in were much more violent and much more hard edged than what he wanted to do. He wanted a proper bit of character development. He wanted the sentiment to be earned, and I think that's one thing about Chaplin. You've got to say that even if you do feel they are too sentimental or the sentiment belongs to a different age, the sentiment is earned in the films. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not just sickly sweet. I mean, it's not like in this day and age where all you have to do is pop a sappy tune on a soundtrack. You don't have that going. And
he didn't have Boyzone.
Yeah,
had to have skill.
Indeed. So I think definitely you look at some of the Hal Roach films from the mid-20s, short two-reelers, there's much more development going on in there anyway. You know, things are earned, whereas there's quite a lot of shorthand in Max Sennett, and quite a lot of the shorthand is quite unpleasant shorthand about women, wives being shrews and men being fine and being able to get away with all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there's so many of them as well. Not that so many of them survive, but there's so many of the Sennett Keystone shorts that, yeah, it is kind of throw them against the wall and see which ones are any good, yeah. Unfortunately.
But, like, I think, yeah, Kaplan and Cheetan, I was going to say.
Yeah, those guys.
Yeah, they're great. You probably haven't read about those guys. Yeah, Keaton and Chaplin both obviously wanted to spread their wings. And, you know, you've got someone who wants to make a film, like Modern Times wants to make a film, eventually, like, you know, The Great Dictator, or someone who wants to make a film like The General, which is just the greatest amount of madness to ever want to make a silent comedy based on a true story from the Civil War and make it look photorealistic.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think they both want to spread their wings in different ways. You know, Chaplin really wanted to touch an audience and move an audience, and Keaton really wanted to kind of explore the limits of what he could do with film. He was very much had an engineer's mind. You know, he used to like to take cameras apart and put them back together and see what he could do with them. And I think you get that sense of precision in his, you might not get be moved as much. But I do agree what you were saying about Chaplin, how the sentiment is earned. I remember the first time I saw that famous final close-up from City Lights, it was shown, I saw it out of context. It was shown on like a clip show, and they said, this is one of the greatest close-ups ever, so moving. And I didn't really get anything from it. But it's only when you see what he's been through in that whole story to kind of, you know, to make the money for this girl that you get the sheer power of that final image. So he really did kind of put the work in to make you care about these people and, you know, really move you, not just in a cheap way.
Yeah, it's not just about, you know, there's a girl and there's a problem. There is always a girl and a problem, but you care about the characters, you're interested in them, you know, all the way through. I mean, and Chaplin, I think, obviously very sophisticated at what he was doing. He knew exactly what he wanted to do.
Oh, I don't think there was... I mean, someone's once said to me that everything he did was planned and contrived, and I think that's 100% correct. I think that, you know, there's... And no one's given me an answer to this, so if anyone can, but in the pawn shop, he has a date up, he has a calendar up, and it's the date of his brother's birthday. Mm-hmm. And no one's ever been able to tell me that. So that's quite an interesting one. Yeah. But everything, even down to when he takes the piece of paper out from the newspaper in the kid, and he hands it over to the guy from the authorities and says, well, you know, he's practically mine, but he's not. It's a police gazette magazine, and you know, the famous story about Chaplin is that he ended up on the cutting room floor from a Keystone Cops film. So that could be linked. These little subtle things, and that's what I love about him, is that he actually, you know, he leaves you thinking about this stuff. And like I said before, coming from where he was born, the sense of humour is very geographical. It's a very dark, it's a very sarcastic sense of humour, and you see it up until the very last film that he made, you see that. And I think that that's quite important. But obviously, that's a very geographic thing. Only people from there can feel it. But it doesn't mean that that's where his appeal lies. Yeah. It's everywhere.
I mean, if only we had someone here from Kansas who could tell us what Buster Keaton means to them.
Yeah, exactly.
Some of our colleagues from the Kansas State Silent Film Festival have
Both Keaton and Chaplin really represented the everyman. Mm. You know, Keaton was the everyman who kind of takes the hits and is very stoical and kind of keeps coming back for more. And Chaplin was the dreamer, you know, the guy who's like down his luck and wants to kind of, you know, get up there, get the girl, get the kind of higher position in life. So that's was the secret of their, you know, their popularity and success.
I mean, it is interesting that the Chaplin is most thought of as the little tramp, whereas Keaton ostensibly was playing different roles in all of his films. But deep down, of course, it's that you're a comic actor. You play on your comic role. And I mean, the one person we haven't really mentioned here is Harold Lloyd. And again, it's, you know, you whether it's having a physical tick or a costume you wear or having a face, it still doesn't mean you're going to do much different when you're in there, apart from you play on your expertise at wringing the laughs out of the situation. And it's building those situations. Yeah, these were writer directors for a reason, because they controlled as much of the film as they possibly could.
Yeah.
When they could.
Yeah. I mean, with someone like Chaplin, his career just kind of like grew and grew. And obviously we know that with Buster Keaton, what happened to him was, you know, a much sadder story. And, you know, he was still working, as you say, he was still making films, but it wasn't what he wanted.
He's the kind of guy who really needed to control his movies. I mean, Chaplin was, you know, he's in a fortunate position where he had total control. Very few people have ever had as much autonomy as he did over his films. But Keaton, yeah, once The General had flopped and he'd moved studios and he'd lost that freedom, he was never the same actor. And it was really, sad, because could he have made the leap into talkies and, you know, as Chaplin did. Chaplin really embraced it. But he never really had the chance, because his career had sort of collapsed as they were coming in.
It's quite sad seeing some of the early sort of talkies with Keaton in, because there's the period where he's partnered with Jimmy Durante, I believe, Yeah.
But it was a bad time for him personally.
Yes,
as well,
bad time him personally. And yeah, he, you know, he was in a very odd sort of double act. He had a fine voice and actually quite a good singing voice as well. But yeah, I think it was partially what was going on personally. The flops really hit him.
Yeah.
Lack of control.
I mean, Chaplin, obviously, you know, you say, obviously, and you're right, he embraced the talkies and that he made fantastic sound films, but he actually resisted them for quite a while.
Yeah,
I mean, he waited
did.
To do it on his own terms. Mm. And then even went back in the sound era, went back and added his own soundtracks to silent films.
Yeah,
so it's all around
Rush.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's perhaps not my favourite one.
There is still a big debate about the 1925 and the 1940s Gold Rush and, you know, which...
I think that was a bad idea to go back and redo it with a voiceover in the Gold Rush. I feel like it says a lot of what does not need to be said.
I think it's another show of his resistance to sound film, because I think he sort of did that to try to revitalise a film that was already a classic. But, you know, it's given it another dimension, but the jury's still out whether it's a good one, really. It's the most diplomatic way I can say
it. The music's great.
Definitely.
Music that he wrote is fine. The
voiceover is too much, I think. Yeah. But there's actually a great... The very opening scene of City Lights, actually a great send-up of talkies, because, you know, they're unveiling this statue, and as soon as everyone opens their mouth, it just comes up with a noise, a kind of gobbledygook, which I guess was his kind of way of sticking it to the... When you expect someone to talk, he stuck it to the talkies in that way. So.
Yeah, only, and even like he always had like the tramp won't speak. So it's, you know, at the end of the modern times, it's the tramp doesn't really speak.
No,
speaks but not.
Again, the jury is out whether or not the character in The Great Dictator is the tramp or not, isn't it? You know, it's sort of an evolved tramp that's not a tramp anymore.
Grown up and working. Yeah.
I mean, I just want to say my one film I think gets overlooked a lot as well is Monsieur Verdoux. Mm-hmm. Monsieur Verdoux. I know it's a talkie, so it's not really Silent London, but it's a great film. It's very dark. It's and there's some great scenes in that, some amazing scenes, and I think that it really gets overlooked. People sort of don't go past The Great Dictator for anything later, and I think it's a great film.
Well, I mean, Limelight is obviously the film that unites you both.
Mm. Yes.
Very briefly.
Yeah,
very briefly.
Indeed, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a beautiful scene. That is a sentimental film, but that's a beautiful film. It's really wonderful, really wonderfully done.
You'd love to have seen a movie with the two of them together as a kind of double act, a kind of buddy movie or something.
Too much. Would have been too much.
Would it?
Yeah. On the
Silent.
Yeah,
on
the road.
I'd have
together.
Taken that risk.
But that's another thing, isn't it? That people, you know, that there is this big rivalry, and I think it's really only amongst the people that like them, because they were the best of friends. But what I never ever understand is in Chaplin's autobiography, he never mentions Buster Keaton, not once.
You do wonder whether on a professional level there was rivalry, but not sort of personally.
I think he just decided that it was his book.
Yes.
Because
he's not going to mention the circus.
He doesn't ever once talk about Rolly Tovaro, but he talks about the most random people he meets in hotel lobbies, which is, you know, quite interesting. But
he was not the skilled memoirist that we might want. I think it's quite interesting, you know, obviously it's the most facetious thing to pit the two against each other, but I do find there are a lot of people, and I was kind of quite surprised when I started the website how many people were so keen, well, particularly how many people were so keen on Buster Keaton, who I thought was a little bit more forgotten than he is, and also the fact that there are people online who are talking in, you know, Team Buster and Team Charlie terms.
Yeah, I think that's a bit much.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, definitely.
One of the best experiences I've had in a cinema this year was at the London Comedy Festival at the BFI earlier this year. They showed a double bill of Sherlock Jr. and one of Keaton's early two-reelers, The Boxer, where he plays...
The Champion.
Yes. And it was an audience full of kids. It was a special kind of kids' screen, and they just howled with laughter at both, and they were totally transfixed. And I think that's kind of... what they have, they speak across generations and across, you know, the decades, and both of them do that just as brilliantly as each other, really.
Yeah. I think sort of the paradox of Charlie Chaplin at the moment is he's so big that no one's really sticking up for him, and it's almost like he's so big everyone knows him, so he's actually getting underrated. I sort of spoke to people on Twitter this afternoon, and I said, you know, nominate your favourite silent comedies, and I had Sherlock Jr., Steamboat Bill Jr., The General. I had all sorts. It took a while before someone came up with 1 AM, and it was their second choice. And then someone else mentioned City Lights in passing. And it's like, I mean, I don't think that reflects the quality of the films. It's just, I think people think it's just so obvious. They're a bit like, oh, I just saw Sherlock Jr., you know, and I love it. We did get quite a few different recommendations. I'm going to take through some interesting ones, see what you think.
I think the thing is as well, people think they know Chaplin, but they don't know Chaplin. I think that's a big thing as well. And the problem is with things like The Artist and films like that come out, these things go through fashionable phases.
Oh, we just had our winner of this week's Mention the Artist.
Okay, right, you had to take a shot.
I thought it was going to be me, but well done.
I was going to say, I've actually decided not to bring this one print out, but Vincent said the general, he's saying that watched it one time at Christmas with his family, and it had three generations of the family transfixed for the whole thing. And I had an awful lot of comments like that about Buster Keaton films. I had a shout out for An Eastern Westerner by Harold Lloyd. So that's one of his shorts. Mm. So, you know, they're not as forgotten as we think. We also had... We had Charlie Chase in Limousine Love.
I haven't seen that one.
I'm just hoping there's some good trouser action. Apparently, according to, I think it's Shirley from the Toronto Silent Film Festival, it's an escalating absurdist masterpiece that finishes with a synchronised effort worthy of the Olympics. Sexy, smart and riveting.
Wow.
Sounds like there are trousers involved.
Yeah, there are probably trousers involved.
Or no trousers involved, which is even better.
Yeah.
Well, that's you, Phil. Trevor, who actually is from Kansas, said that he liked Sold at Auction because it's about a million miles an hour and Snub Pollard is a riot. Now, have we got any Snub Pollard fans in the room?
I don't know anything about Snub Pollard at all.
Kind of funny guy, funny looking guy. There's actually a clip of that online. I'm storified some of these tweets, and I put a clip in of that one because I think, you know, it maybe isn't that well known. I love this comment about Sherlock Jr. from Rick. A mix of whimsy and wonder, influential, but more than that, tremendous fun. And he literally jumps through a man.
Let's do that.
This is a wonderful, also from Toronto, also from the Toronto Silent Film Festival. Chaplin's 1 AM is like watching a tightrope walker over the abyss. That's a great comment.
I do love 1 AM. I think there was some great comments about 1 AM at Slapstick, actually. Mm-hmm. I've watched someone come home like that once, a bit drunk. It was quite amusing. No one I was related to, thank goodness. I just want to say as well, the whole Keaton Chaplin thing is quite personal because my fiance is a Keaton fan, and we do actually have, this goes on quite a lot.
You're practiced at this debate.
Oh, yeah, definitely, even though he'll tell you it's not a debate.
I sometimes wonder if people don't think of Chaplin quite so much as the Chaplin films as comedies almost, because, you know, because there's so much more to them in some ways that maybe when they think about just laughing out loud, because, as you say, you come out and you do feel you are moved or whatever, that actually you don't, I mean, everyone knows Chaplin's a comedian, but I suppose maybe they don't feel that way directly afterwards, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe his features perhaps a bit better known than things like, you know, Easy Street or whatever.
Yeah, that's true.
I love Easy Street.
No arguments on Easy Street, I don't think, in the room. Well, all
is
of it.
It's terrific.
We are spoiled for choice here with silent films. I think we're going to move on to the next thing now. I love to do my segues.
Yeah,
speaking of favourite silent films. Right, okay. We're lucky enough, we've got a contribution from across the water from Chris Edwards, who writes the great blog Silent Volume. I don't know if you've read it. Mm-hmm. He reviews silent films, and he has contributed to us quite a few words about his favourite silent film, which, is a very special film.
Hello, this is Chris Edwards talking about my favourite silent film, Exit Smiling, filmed in 1926, starring Beatrice Lilly and Jack Pickford, brother of Mary, directed by Sam Taylor. Now, I find it hard to come up with one silent film that I would call my favorite. I think depending on the kind of day I'm having and where I am, the favorite might change. But Exit Smiling is the one that I love the most all the time. And given the kind of connection that we try to create between silent films and ourselves with the music and the images, I really think it is an emotional connection. And so if I can say that I love Exit Smiling the most, I think that qualifies it as number one. Exit Smiling is a comedy. It stars Lily as Violet, who is the worst actress in a very bad traveling troupe of actors called the Orlando Wainwright Repertory Company. They go from town to town by train, performing a very terrible play called Flaming Women, which the movie basically makes fun of throughout, talking about how various towns are afflicted with flaming women or forced to sit through it. It's a running joke, I think, all the way along, but it's also important because people at the time would have known that a lot of the biggest actors and actresses in the history of silent film got their start in exactly that kind of really cruddy little theater production, including Mary Pickford. It makes sense that a character like Violet, who dreams really big, who wants to be a star so badly, could believe that that would be her vehicle for achieving it, even though the play is terrible. And the other actors, even the ones that are way higher up the ladder than she is, are also terrible. It is a very funny film. It'll crack you up every minute. It's filled with gags. In particular, I really like a running gag that they have with signage. For example, you'll see a no smoking sign in the background, and everybody will be firing up a cigar or a pipe or a smoke of some kind. Another time we see quiet please, everybody's talking. Another time we see a door that says no admittance and people just bust right through it. I mean, that's the kind of thing that really typifies the film. It is always trying to make you laugh. It's always working. And in the background, there's always something going on that can keep you going. It really rewards you with repeat viewings. And I have seen it more than once, so I do know. I think that Sam Taylor, as the director, his work ages very well. He also directed Mary Pickford in My Best Girl, which is a late feature for her that really deviates from type. And I think for a lot of new fans of silent film, or people just trying to get into that kind of filmmaking, they find My Best Girl to be the film, the Pickford film, that is the most accessible. It's very much against type. He really liked his characters to be natural. He liked them to be subtle. He liked them to have a lot of emotional depth and possibly even pain underneath the jokes. That is seen in those films, and it's really seen in Exit Smiling, where he had the services of a lead actress who was incredibly gifted as a comedian, but who insisted on really delivering all of her jokes, all of her performances, from a core real character rather than just the gag itself, letting it just sort of hang there in the air. It's a subtle character-driven piece from her. Amazingly, Beatrice Lilly had never before appeared in a movie. It was her first silent film, and actually it was also her last. She did a few films after that, including a very early sound film. But this was her only silent performance, and it's amazing how completely she gets it and how moving the performance is. She was actually born in Ontario. Just as an aside, a little patriotic aside, just like me. And depending on the source that you take it from, she might have been born in Toronto, which is where I live. So a hometown girl, and we're very proud to have her. Other things I might say about this film, it has no real villains, which is another thing I think typifies some of Taylor's work. There is a character that you would call the villain. He's the bad guy. He causes problems. But over the course of the film, you get the impression that he's just a person with vices who, all things being equal, would really rather be a good guy himself or not be in the position he's in or not put other people in the positions he puts them in. The final big gag in the film, which is a long sequence with Beatrice Lilly and this actor, really goes to show how that character can't, or he can be manipulated because he really is decent deep down. And when you have a character, or when you have a movie with no villains, no real villains, that means that anything bad that happens to anybody is happening to somebody who's basically good. And I think that's kind of a sad thing. You sort of regret it. It's a bit melancholy. And that really is part of what Exit Smiling is. It is also a love story. Jack Pickford plays Jimmy, who is, I guess you'd say, a drifter with a past, who joins the troupe. Beatrice Lilly's Violet falls totally in love with him, and he's a good guy too. Maybe he doesn't love her back, maybe it's mostly in her mind, but she legitimately pines for him, and you do want her to succeed. You want her to succeed in every way. You want her to succeed in her dreams, even if she doesn't have the talent. You want her to succeed with Jimmy, even if he's not interested, and it really drives the movie forward, along with the jokes, of the sense of pain that is underneath. I should add that this film is not that easy to find. Exit Smiling is available from Warner Archives in the USA for order, special order. So if you have an opportunity to see the Warner Archives version, you will get Linda Martinez's score, which, in my opinion, is one of the finest scores I have ever heard to accompany a silent film. It is deeply sympathetic to the complexities of the characters and the story. It would be possible with a score that was just sort of tone deaf, that just wanted to be completely upbeat and happy all the time, that you could have really obliterated the dignity of Lily's performance here. But what Martinez is able to do, you know, at times with some very grim music, a lot of woodwinds, a lot of strings, is to really understand when, you know, Beatrice Lily's character is not trying to be happy, or she's not upbeat or joyful. She's wistful. She's longing. She's frightened. Oh, and when bad things happen, the music knows it. It really puts you in a dramatic sort of soundscape, which adds a great deal. And you know, a bad score can ruin any film, particularly a silent film, as any fan knows. And kudos to her for really, really getting this film and helping everybody else to get it that much more. I don't have too much longer to talk. I could say a million things about this film. I want to end by quoting myself, which is a little pretentious, but I did write up this piece on my blog, Silent Volume, and what I closed with on that blog is really what I believe and why I think that this film is something that really ought to be seen by everybody. And so here I go. The people in Exit Smiling make bad choices, then expect victory, making it simultaneously one of the funniest and most moving silent films I've ever seen. It's also one of the most relevant. Exit Smiling matters because it is a reflection of our times as much as its own. We've come to prize aspiration and persistence almost as much as success. Our society romanticizes dreams as though the capacity to maintain one in the face of crushing reality is an achievement unto itself. Visit the self-help section of any bookstore to see the fruits of this. There will be a violet standing next to you. Thank you very much.
So Beatrice Lily, who obviously Chris was claiming as a Toronto girl, perhaps, you know, buried in Berry, I think you'll find she married a Brit. And no, she didn't make very many films, so it's understandable that she's not one of the first names we think about when we think about silent comedy. But sort of springing off from that, we wanted to talk about some of the lesser known comics and a few other kinds of silent comedy. So I know that Pete and I are kind of itching to talk about Charlie Chase. I think we talk about him every time.
We do, don't we? I think it's because today we've discovered more Charlie Chase trouser-based humour.
We were sharing the trouser fun.
We were. And it's just, I mean, there are so many bits and bobs. I mean, I think what I like about Charlie Chase is his ability to be very respectable as a lead character, but just the world fall apart around him. What were we watching earlier?
We watched a little bit of Accidental Accidents, didn't we?
Which is
where he gets caught in the rain and his trousers fill with water. And again, yeah, not comfortable. I mean, he really excelled at the comedy of embarrassment, really. It's kind of like little sitcoms, really, and with the farcical element. But there's a few others, like Romeo and Juliet. We also have Sponges Down His Leggings.
I love that one.
Yeah.
That's the one where he's in the Romeo and Juliet play, yeah. Isn't it? We saw it with slapstick. Yeah, that really made me laugh.
But what we came across today was what looks like a short reconstructed one on YouTube, which is The Way of All Pants, where Charlie Chase plays someone who delivers some trousers to a woman who then, for her husband, she demands them to be... see what they look like on. So he puts them on. The husband sees him doing this from outside and believes that he may be a suitor of hers. Farce ensues, but the farce completely revolves around people losing their trousers. And there's a dog, of course, that steals the trousers. There's much of undoing of belts and people walking out of their trousers. There's a tablecloth stuffed down trousers that then loses all of its bits. And finally, there's...
Dishes, you mean? I don't know.
Yes, a dish. Yes, or dishes, yes.
And trousers lose their bits. What does that mean?
And there's a final bit, which would be... is quite, say, Keaton-esque, where he's hanging from some telegraph wires and his trousers fall off as well. And then he falls into a bus as after being shot. And it's just, you know, we do always talk about Charlie Chase. I feel a bit bad that we've spoken more about Charlie Chase on Silent London than we have Harold Lloyd.
Yes, well, Harold Lloyd, I'm a big fan of Harold Lloyd. I think that he had such a lovely air about him. I'm obviously biased towards anyone who wears spectacles well, mm-hmm. although, you know, they were fake. I mean, I think it's quite interesting. We always talk about the danger that people put themselves on, and obviously Harold Lloyd did blow his fingers off with a bomb.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, that was quite a scary moment, I think. And, you know, when you look at Saves You Last and you see that he's doing, you know, doing those stunts one-handed. But what I think is interesting is not Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin, but he did influence, you know, those thrill comedies that he made, you know, that really influenced Buster Keaton, and it influenced Charlie Chaplin making The Circus, you know.
I was about to say The Circus. Yeah. You were talking about trousers again. He loses his trousers.
Yeah. With a monkey on his head and his trousers off. I mean, just, I always describe that film as beautiful, but really, it's quite...
He's got quite good knees as well.
Oh, Aisha.
I can't remember Buster's knees. I can't comment. So.
That could do it. That could do it. It's the battle of the knees. But, we've been talking like during the week, and we were saying that, you know, obviously silent comedy, and we talk about these great Hollywood slapstick icons. We're very, you know, there's a lot to talk about there. But we're really quite keen on some European comedy, because you didn't have to be in Keystone Studios to make people laugh. I mean, you had a few you wanted to mention, didn't you?
Well, yeah. Within the last year, I've really been introduced to a number of comedies from quite unexpected sources as well, particularly during the Carl Theodore Dreyer season at the BFI earlier this year. You know, we know Dreyer as a very austere filmmaker, serious religious dramas. But at the start of his career, he made two really brilliant comedies. One is called The Master of the House, which is a very funny domestic drama about...
Quite a feminist domestic drama.
All of his films have a real kind of feminist bent to them, and he loves having these really formidable battle axes. He must have known a few in real life. And The Master of the House is about a man who's really under the thumb from this old woman who comes in and takes control of the place after he's been, you know, very mean to his wife. That's a really terrific film. But he also made a film called The Parson's Widow, which I think is fit to stand alongside any of his great masterpieces. That's a very funny movie about a young man who comes to a small village hoping to be the new parson there. And he gets the job, but the condition is that he has to marry the widow of the previous parson. And this turns out to be a very old woman who has outlived about four or five different contenders.
May perhaps be some kind of supernatural element involved. Some kind of witch
who will never die. And the poor parson has his girlfriend who has to pretend to be his sister. And it really plays like a kind of farce in many ways, which you don't expect this from Dreyer, but he's got a real light touch with the comedy. But the most brilliant thing about it then is that it segues into this incredibly moving finale, and there's nothing forced about it at all. It's a really beautiful moment. And his judgment of the tone is just incredible. So that was one of the most surprising films I've seen recently.
I mean, talking of farce, Italian Straw Hat, Rene Clair, was a terrific film from early. We caught at the Barbican earlier this year, and is a good hour and 10 of ridiculous farce.
Instead of trying to go for sentiment there, for more, it's more using the laughs to get like social comment. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's still very funny because it's still a man trying to put boots on that are like two sizes too small. And, you know, he had a message, didn't he, with that film, which is something that you talk about with Chaplin, actually. Yeah.
And silent film does lead itself to farce quite well. I mean, what surprised me was at the British Silent Film Festival, I think I mentioned this last time, were the Woodhouse adaptations, the two I saw, The Clicking of Cuthbert and The Long Hole. There are a few others as well, which were basically based on golfing stories. And you wouldn't think the Woodhouse would, you know, lend itself at all to being adapted into silent film. Mm-hmm. And yet, a mixture of some very good erudite intertitles and some, you know, in the end, what are basically some toffs being silly. And
always good.
And they're all golf stories. So in the end, there are some, dare I say it, ridiculous trousers.
That's the trousers.
Obsessed, I'm sorry.
It's a Silent London comedy trousers special.
Yes,
I think
there's another brilliant performer that I'd like to mention who many people might not know about is Ozzy Osvaldor,
who I
discovered in the Ernst Lubitsch early silent set. She made a couple of films with him in 1918-1919. One was called I Don't Want to Be a Man, where she cross-dresses, and another was called Die Puppe, or The Doll, where she plays this lifelike doll and is kind of taken by this young man to be his wife, and it's, you know, hilarious results. And she's an incredible physical comedienne. Really no kind of vanity about her. She's got limbs all over the place, amazing facial expressions. And I found her absolutely transfixing. And I don't think her career ever really developed far beyond those early silent.
Yeah,
I haven't seen much of her since then. But in those two films, she gives two of the best comic displays you're likely to see.
I mean, yeah, playing the doll. I mean, the idea is that the husband thinks he's married a doll and she knows she's a real person. And it's that, I mean, it's Lubitsch, it's classic. Mm. You know, they're actually married to each other and they actually sort of want to be with each other, but they're sort of pretending to be different things.
It's also one of Lubitsch's most visually stunning films. Mm. I mean, really, like the set decoration is like a kind of toy box environment, which is, it was really totally unexpected and one of his greatest works, I think.
Yeah, it's my other half's favourite silent film, actually. It's only 20 minutes long, isn't it?
Well, it does raise the question about it being a direct, the comedy being a director's medium as much as the lead character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the queries around Harry Langdon and Capra, whether, you know, Harry Langdon's best films, the ones with Capra, whether these ones without Capra were any good at all. And, yeah, there are some big names that do come, that pick up, that you see later for a sound film, really cutting their teeth. In silent comedy, in those two reels, some of the Charlie Chase ones, for example.
Yeah, well, I mean, Charlie Chase, he was a director before he got in front of the camera. I think it's quite interesting, now we think about a comedy star, and we might think of someone that's done stand-up or that can just act well in a comedy. You know, I mean, you know, Jennifer Aniston is a comedy star. She sort of does comedy acting.
No, it's one debatable.
Thinks, yeah, I'm not sure you picked the best example.
No one suggests that she ever wrote a line or decided how to shoot a bit of comedy. You know, she was just in like popular sitcom.
But it is an area where you do get these writer directors and so on. I mean, even now you get, you know, your Tina Feys are doing, you know, they're in control of their own series. They launched a series.
And Kristen Wiig did Bridesmaids.
Yeah. So it does still happen. And I think that's because it is all about control. You feel you have to be in charge of the timing. The timing's in the edit.
No one's going to be able to make like as many films as, you know, they were making when they were making those short two-reelers. Though, I mean, Kristen Wiig, you know, she's going to make one in like 2 years' time or however how long it took her to get to that. It's a different environment to work as a comedian, I think.
Yeah. Well, it was what I was going to say about the recent film, The Fairy, that just came out. A Belgian, Australian co-production, I guess it is, which is, you know, it's very slapstick. It's you look at it, it's an hour and 20 minutes long. There are probably two or three gags worthy of maybe a Max Sennett two-reeler in it, and there's a lot of repetition and everything's a lot slower. And I, you know, I really like the physicality of the performers, but, you know, they don't hold a candle to, unfortunately, because I did like their previous film, Rumba, a lot. But the gags lack the danger, they lack the sense of something new happening here almost.
There are a lot of really neat ideas in it. Yeah. That's what frustrated me, because I feel like they've just haven't really exploited the potential in a lot of these gags. You know, there's a little dog running around in the bag, nothing really happens with that. There's, you know, the chase down the street is okay. There's a lot of stuff that just, I felt like it either went on too long or it just didn't really go anywhere.
Yeah, there's
I liked Rumba as well. I thought it was a much sharper movie.
Yeah, but
so do we think that maybe now, you know, silent comedy, I mean, it's found its natural home in sort of cartoons and stuff for children. You know, we talk about the Pixar films and we talk about, you know, like Roadrunner cartoons and things like that. I mean, is that you think it's more its natural home, or do you think it's going to go back to more adult?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I get quite frustrated with people that love like Jackie Chan films and Rush Hour and, you know, things like this, and that you say to them, well, watch a silent film, and they say, don't like them. And it's like, you think to yourself, well, just go and look up Jackie Chan website, he will tell you his biggest hero and inspiration is Buster Keaton. You know, and I think that people are looking back to the origins now because films are too special effects based now. You know, you had the big explosion with Avatar, then Titanic was brought out in 3D. There's all this 3D mania that's going on, and I think that's why we are sort of looking at the past and thinking, well, actually, how did they do it? Because they didn't have any 3D. You know, they had their simple cameras and their editing suites, and then they came up with these amazing things that we see now, and we've appreciated for generations. But for me, I think I'd rather go back and watch one of these films and look at the technical side of how they did it. You know, the Keystone Cops, how did they get 20 million Keystone Cops going through that car? You know, and then you find out how they split the screen and obviously that stuff. And then and you think it's much more better than getting in front of an Apple Mac and then doing all the whizzy editing and then bang, you've got a brilliant film.
I think in terms of comedy, though, comedy today is a very different thing, because most of the successful mainstream comedies are really based around funny guys getting together, improvising, and then putting something together in the edit. They're not visually stimulating. They're not really structured in a clear way. And you don't get many comedies today that are really worked out in the precision detail that the silent comedians did.
Yeah, the beats just aren't there. I mean, it's interesting. Mm. I saw the five-year engagement at the weekend, and there's one fantastic piece of, you know, slapstick, proper slapstick in it, where it just falls out. You know, it's a fall over gag. Whereas when you think of how, you know, but the rest of it, you might as well not be watching it. And it's almost as if, and coming back to the thing you said about clumsy slapstick and lazy slapstick, you know, we've just gone through 15 years where basically every Julia Robertson, go back to Jennifer Aniston film, the way you know it's a rom-com is that she falls over.
Yeah.
Comedy gold.
Yeah, it is, unfortunate.
Because, you know, to me, one of the legacies of silent comedy is actually wit. It's not just about slapstick. I mean, for me, you know, I think, you know, Anita Loes really sort of changed silent film when she started writing her witty intertitles. Now, you know, on here, I love intertitles. If you're talking about pure cinema, I think intertitles can be really wonderful. They have these very compact, witty, often acerbic, often topical, often punning little caption cards. And, you know, I heard it described really really well recently. Well, it's like watching the film with a really witty woman sitting next to you. It's great. It's kind of like, you know, watching X Factor with Twitter on or something. Only funny. That would be the difference.
I think, Pam, what you're actually saying is it's like seeing a film with you.
Oh, of course, of course, because I talk through the film. Hush now.
She doesn't do that.
No, I do not do that. Please don't kick me out of any cinemas. And I think, you know, obviously that particular kind of humour just fed straight into the screwball comedies of the 30s and on. And now, I mean, talk about like Jackie Chan films and even action films, there's always got to be a one-liner, like a funny little bit of dialogue. And, you know, silent comedy, it's not all about, you know, the pies and the rakes.
No, it's not.
Well, you know, I think we've covered quite a lot of comedy, so let's cleanse our palates. We're halfway through the year, and I know that we've all seen quite a lot of you know, great silent film screenings, and we might want to talk about them. Most excitingly, Aisha's just come back from Bologna.
I have.
We saw a film or two.
I'm going to really disappoint you, Pam, because I was in the Chaplin archives for pretty much most of the week.
Surprise, surprise.
Too much work. Tell us what you did see.
Well, I saw a very beautiful Louise Brooks film, which I cannot say the title of because...
Pré-débuté?
That's the one.
Yeah, I probably pronounced it wrong.
My French is terrible as well, so it's fine. But it was a very good film. And it was sort of in the piazza in the main square in Bologna, which, if anyone's ever been, is amazing. The screen is huge. It had a live orchestra and we was all sitting there. And it starts off really quite comic, but it's got such a dark ending. It's real obsession gone mad. And of course, Louise Brooks is absolutely ravishing when you watch her in anything. That is definitely a film that leaves you, you know, you leave sitting there and you think, my gosh, you know, it's a really quite a powerful message when she gets shot at the end. And...
Oh, spoiler.
No spoilers. Oh.
An old film, I think.
Yes,
so
thank you. How could you spoil a very old film? It was actually a fantastic festival, and a lot of people were actually saying about the really amazing things that were going on. I had to fly home early because of work, and I missed a fantastic presentation that was given about the restoration of Limelight that was done by David Robinson and Cecilia, who looks after the Chaplin archive in Bologna. And it was apparently an amazing job of what they're doing with the restoration of it. And there's a lot more information coming out about that film this year, because Calvero was a character that apparently Chaplin never really put to bed. He wanted to do much more with it, but unfortunately didn't get a chance.
Because just in case people don't know, in Bologna, what it has been this past week, it's Cinema Ritrovato. It's like a festival of restored films, isn't it?
So the best film I saw, has to be said, was The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which wasn't a silent film, but it's
a beautiful film.
It's been restored, and it is absolutely beautiful. I know they did show in the night that we got there, they showed in the piazza Once Upon a Time in America, which has just been restored with new scenes added in that they found in the archive, and that was 4.5 hours long.
Phil, that sounds like you're
so excited about that. That screened at Cannes, and people were talking about all the new films at Cannes, and the only film that made me jealous was that restored Once Upon a Time in America.
It was amazing.
Phil quite likes a film of a certain size, shall we say.
Indeed. Size does matter when it comes to films.
Two reelers or nothing for me.
I was going to say, what you were saying earlier about when you were talking about Sidney Chaplin, I've been reading the letters between Sidney and Birkin, which was the Chaplin solicitor, and actually there was a big thing with Image in the late 10s and early 20s where there was these impersonators. And it's quite interesting looking at them, just how he actually got hold of his image. Not just his image, but he got hold of the character of the tramp. It wasn't just his name, it was the character. And I think that's early branding. And that's another thing I think he doesn't get credit for. Both of them, great business acumen. And that's why probably when so many films such as Lon Chaney's films and other artists' films don't exist anymore, because of the way that the Chaplin estate has preserved these films and the way that they were looked after under the Chaplin studios, we can still enjoy them now. So we're quite lucky. Being a Chaplin fan, you're quite lucky.
I have to come to you, Phil, because, you know, it did just make me think, well, obviously I know you've seen a few silent films here, but we just recently saw Ben-Hur, didn't mm-hmm. we?
It was one I'd been looking forward to for some time. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason I was looking forward to it was less to do with the reputation of the film than the reputation of the making of it. It was notorious for being the most expensive silent film ever made. And it was famous for being just the sheer scale of it was incredible. They used 48 cameras to shoot certain the two big sequences in it.
There's like an attack at sea.
And the big chariot race. The chariot race was just immense. You know, they shot 200,000 feet of film on it. They actually, Louis B. Mayer actually gave them £100 to the winner to ensure they really went for it, which caused that enormous pile up that you see in the film.
It's brutal. Horses were injured, weren't
they? Horses were injured. There were reports of people dying. I think, you know...
Maybe.
There was a bit vague on that. But it's a fantastic spectacle. It's a gripping story. The first half of it really goes along at a rollicking pace. It sort of climaxes the first half with that sea battle, which is really brutal. There's actually one shot of a guy being tied to the front of a ship and then rammed into the other ship, and there's a...
You don't believe it's going to happen until it does.
And there's a close-up of this poor fella thinking, please, get me off this ship.
I wish everyone could see you now, the way you just gripped yourself.
Like, don't say it, Phil, don't say it.
It was extraordinary. And then, of course, the chariot race is absolutely spectacular. I think the problem with the film is that the chariot race is so incredible. In isolation, it's an amazing piece of work. The film never really recovers after that. You know, you can't top that. It should be the climax of the movie. And there's quite a long stretch afterwards with Ben-Hur's leprosy-ridden mother and sister.
You really don't believe they've got leprosy. You just, oh, yes. Oh, there's another thing to deal with. How that's going to be awkward.
They're wandering around looking for Jesus to cure them.
I didn't dislike that strand of the film as much as virtually every other person I spoke to when we left the screening. Like, all the chaps seemed to be really bothered by that. And I was a bit like, oh, that was sweet.
I think you're on such a high after the chariot race. I've seen the death and destruction. It's like you get back to these guys and think, oh, yeah, I'd forgotten about them. I like the one thing I liked about it very much was the depiction of Jesus, where you only ever see Jesus' right hand.
Yeah.
It's like there'll be a sick person there and Jesus' hand will suddenly kind of come into the frame and cure them and then disappear again. Yeah. And
it's a bit sinister.
It is a bit weird. It's like this disembodied hand floating around. It's like a thing from the Addams Family.
But it is actually quite clever because they don't ever claim what Jesus looks like.
I guess they were kind of being a bit sacred about that. And yet, on the other hand, they had all the nudity they could get away with in a Christian-themed movie.
Yeah. I thought... I think for me, you know, you say like an epic film, I have to say there's a little part of me that, you know, my eyes roll back in my head and I sort of think, you're on. But what is very well done about Ben-Hur is that it's got detail. Mm. It's got detail because you can't just have big scope. You've got to have detail and you have like little funny moments in the crowd, little animals, tiny moments. And, I enjoyed maybe the mother and sister line a little bit more than some people did, you know, just because, you know, I was ready for a little bit of a human moment. A little quiet moment. I think, you know, maybe that's what you get with modern films is often it's all chariot race all the time. Mm.
The scene setting is great at the start. You know, it really opens well when it's, you know, showing the persecution with the Romans and stuff. I thought that was fantastically well done. Yeah. And there's also a nice use of Technicolor in the religious scenes, you know.
Two-strip Technicolor, which looks a bit kind of... It's a bit overwhelming if you watch The Black Pirate and watch like a whole film in it, but it works really well in Ben-Hur, I think.
Yeah. Isolated. And of course, we saw it with the live performance of Carl Davis's score, which was sensational, really.
Yeah,
and
yeah, very envious.
It really added to the experience.
You went on holiday.
I was in China, yes, and I didn't manage to see any of the Chinese silent films I wanted to see while I was there.
I've got a couple of things that I've seen recently. I've been lucky enough that I went to Wilton's musical last Thursday to see The Pleasure Garden. It's the first in the Hitchcock Gala. I know it sounds like I've been talking about Hitchcock nonstop. This is the first one. It's Hitchcock's first film. And it's got a new score from Daniel Patrick Cohen, who's a sort of had two screenings. I have to say, it just looked fantastic. Gorgeous. And they've added in, they've looked at prints all around the world, and they've added in, you know, a few little scenes here and there. And it really makes The Pleasure Garden, which, you know, if you've seen it on a rough DVD, it runs a lot smoother. The whole thing sort of feels much more natural, the story. And there's lots of little comic moments and nice little touches added in. I've also seen the restoration of The Lodger, which is going to show at the Barbican with the London Symphony Orchestra. Nissan Sawney's got a new score for that. It's also going to have a theatrical release, so I've just seen the sort of theatrical print. It looks fantastic. I mean, I love The Lodger. I think it's a really sort of delicate film. It's the third film that Hitchcock made. I mean, I think, you know, obviously it's a great London film. Again, there's some really clever tinting that they've restored, and everything's looking wonderful. You know, the intertitles are very important in The Lodger, you know, not to go back to that, but the design of the intertitles are very important. It's gorgeous. I'm slightly on the fence about the score as we stand. I know.
Controversial.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to go and see it at the Barbican, and I think it's maybe going to work better in a big hall. I felt it was a little bit too much. I think that The Lodger is quite a delicate film. It's quite unsettling. There are lots of sort of nervous moments where you don't really know what's going to happen, and or rather two things are happening at once, and the score kind of lets you be jaunty or sort of reference Psycho. And there are some surprises in there as well. I'm looking forward to hearing it again, and I'm really interested to see what other people think of it.
I think people sort of overlook Hitchcock a bit before Psycho. Mm-hmm. A lot of people start their life off with Hitchcock, with Psycho or The Birds. But when I was in Bologna, we saw Murder. Oh. Murder is a fantastic film. Absolutely brilliant. I love the clipped accents in it. It's just fantastic.
Queen's English.
Yes, that's the one.
The one I'm really looking forward to, actually, is The Ring.
Oh, that's a fantastic
film.
Yeah,
which I just love boxing movies. So oh. I'm kind of like, oh. Hitchcock boxing movie, I'm in.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it, no. Oh, no. I'm looking forward to seeing that. I don't think I can make the screen at the Hackney Picture House, but I'll see it at the BFI when it's screened.
Yeah, it's at the Hackney Empire with Soweto Kinch. I should be there for the gala. But yeah, that's one of my top recommendations for Silent Hitchcock. Mm. I think it's a great film. It's really him showing off quite a lot, and that's always enjoyable. I'm always recommending that people go and see The Manx Man as well to enjoy.
It's a big summer of Hitchcock.
Big summer of Hitchcock. They haven't all been announced yet. A few of them have. So we've got dates for Champagne and Blackmail and Easy Virtue even, but we haven't got dates for everything. So if you want to go and see sort of Downhill and a few other things like that, they're still TBA. I have got a few other little picks I want to grab out of the silent film listings, because you know we do have full listings for silent film screenings in London on the website, and there are a few things coming up that are a little bit out of the ordinary. The first thing I really want to talk about is The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is always a great film, always worth watching, but a musician called Martin Jacks has is it Jacks or Jakes?
I think it's Jakes.
Jakes. I didn't do my research. Martin Jakes from the sort of punk cabaret band, the Tiger Lilies. Look it up and correct me. he's got a residency at the Soho Theatre. He's doing sort of 12 shows of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and he's got quite an eccentric sort of, you know, punky style. And the film, I think we'll say, has got a very eccentric punky style. So I think that could be a match made in heaven. It's going to be just exciting to think there's that many screenings going on, really.
Yeah, Jacks.
It's Martin Jacks.
But it's easy.
There's another thing that's really caught my eye, which is at the BFI, and I don't have too many details about this, but, you know, when people talk about silent film, a lot of people say it's like watching an opera, or, you know, for me, it's like watching ballet. I really enjoy ballet. And there is a film directed by a woman called Lois Weber, a Hollywood film called The Dumb Girl of Portici, which features Anna Pavlova dancing. I've seen some clips of it. There's this sort of strange sequence when she's performing in front of a black backdrop with a dancer who's dressed entirely in black, so he's sort of supporting her for her jumps, but you can't see him, so it's quite a magical look. I'm really looking forward to that. That's showing at the BFI South Bank on the 11th of August.
That was at Bologna.
Ah, did you see it?
I didn't, but a mutual friend of ours did, and he said that she didn't dance enough.
Yeah, it's only a small segment, I think. Yeah. But it's a Louise Weber film, so Lois Weber film. Keep saying Louise.
You know, unfortunately, my festival was listening to what other people were saying in the coffee shop when I came out of the archives, but I did see some films, but a lot of people were saying that was a very, very good film.
Oh, I'm really excited. Yeah, that's definitely ticking my boxes. I think One thing that is coming up, just because we have spoken about it before and I may have ranted slightly on the website, the White Shadow is going to be shown at the BFI as part of the Hitchcock season, and Charles Barr is going to be talking about early Hitchcock and he's going to show that. And just in case anyone doesn't remember, The White Shadow is a Graham Cutts film that Hitchcock worked on, and we've wound two reels, what, half an hour or something, was found in an archive last year. So that's going to be really exciting to see that. The other thing I wanted to talk about was Drifters, which is the gruesome documentary, and that's the Sonic Cinema event at BFI South Bank on 17th of August. We talked a lot about Greed last time too, mm-hmm. and Greed is showing on the 20th and the 26th of August at BFI South Bank.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. I know that somebody's doing their homework.
I'm currently reading McTeague, the book that Greed was based on. A little bit disappointing it's not the 10-hour version, but you can't have everything.
10-hour version of the book or the...
Read a book in 10 hours, that'd be pretty impressive.
Very impressive. It's time for us to live up to our name and depart the airwaves now. Please join us again for the next Silent London podcast, when we hope to take a look at the women of the silent era. Thank you to SOAS for welcoming us into your studio. Thanks to Pete.
Hello, thank you very much, yes.
To Aisha.
Thank you.
To Phil.
Thank you.
To Neil Brand. And thanks to you for listening. If you want to respond to anything we've been talking about today, you'll find all the details on the website at silentlondon.co.uk, together with those silent film listings. Goodbye and enjoy the silence.